You know, when I hear that song, it causes me to think that that would be a pretty good introduction to Shattering Myths. I know it's long, and we probably, play too much of it even here. But when you think about the lyrics of that song and what it's essentially saying is that we're going to go camp out with God in His land, and He's going to strengthen us. He's going to lead us. We're going to be free. It certainly provides the right perspective from which to consider the world today and His testimony.
Yeah.
Hello, JB. How are you?
I'm good.
That's good. I am spending my free time translating Daniel, God Judges and Vindicates, 7, 8, and 9. Have you ever given that much thought? You know, it's the story that begins in both cases with Babylon transitioning into or being conquered by the Median Persians and the Persians being conquered by the Greeks, and then the Greeks being conquered by the Romans, and then out of the Roman Empire comes a beast that is essentially a 21st century edition of Paul. And he is a bad, bad dude. And it talks about what's going to happen during the last days. It's, I can tell you one thing for sure. In fact, I can tell you several things. One is that you don't want to be there. It is just going to be nasty. But the other thing I can tell you is just the desolation, the estrangement, the corruption. It's just going to be massive on scale. But the other thing is that Christians are going to love the Antichrist. You know, if I want to use the, since that's their term, the Antichrist, as is Christian, is their term too, they're going to love him. And he is going to sound, say, do, proclaim, want exactly what Paul said, did, and wrote and wanted. They're indistinguishable.
Yeah, I always got to kick out of all these Christians, and you know, you see all this like Left Behind series and all these
right.
End-time movies and books they write, and it's always all the Christians are aware and all that. It's like, really, you know, it even tells us in there that, you know, he's going to fool most of the world. The majority of the world are Christians.
That's correct. Oh, yeah, it's going to be very few people that aren't fooled. And of course, America gets devastated, and it's the most Christian of nations. But every aspect of this guy, thus far, I haven't seen anything that says that there's going to be a new temple. I know there's a lot of people that say that it has to be a new temple for the sacrifices to cease. It's not so much that he is not inviting people to participate in and talking about the merits of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. It's just that he is has no interest in it. It's exactly like Paul. It's not, you know, Paul doesn't speak against Passover. He just has no interest in it. And that's basically what's being said here. So it's, you know, this notion that there has to be a new temple and that the Passover and the like, the sacrifices have resumed only to be stopped in the middle of the tribulation. That's not what seems to be the case. It seems to be that this guy's got his own agenda. He has his own times. It's like Paul, you know, that don't pay attention to the Shabbat. Don't pay attention to Yahweh's days, his invitations. And so, you know, you're free to do whatever you want to do because you have total freedom. All you have to do is believe. It's very similar to that. That sounds like the agenda. And the set apart, and the set apart in heaven are taking the approach of, wow, I mean, this is just revolting. How long is this rebellion going to last? And one of the things that I have found in this whole thing, and I'm not finished with it, so I'm not going to pretend that I understand all of the events, but the statement that Yahweh makes in the midst of Yeshaya 18, where he has saved Israel from the onslaught of Muslims, And he has, previous to that, he has brought his children into heaven. And then he's warned the United States, and then he's put his banner up and just says, and I think his banner is going to be his 10 statements in stone. I think he's going to have the angel that is currently monitoring the Ark of the Covenant. I think he's going to have him hold up the 10 statements that he etched in stone and say, you are now without excuse. Here's my name. Here's my position. This is what I have asked. And then he's going to blow his shofar so everybody pays attention to it. And from that moment on, for 3.5 years, God's not going to be here. He's going to let the adversary and the fallen demons, and this has a huge, four times, places where Daniel is witnesses the spiritual messengers fall right along with Satan, with the beast. And for 3.5 years, it's their world. They set the rules. They run the place. And God gives them free reign. So it really will be
bad now. Just wait until then.
Pardon?
I said, if you think it's bad now, just wait until then. It'll literally be hell on earth.
It really will be. It's pretty close to that right now.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure there's a lot of difference between, you know, a Barack Obama and the adversary, the beast. You know, the beast, though, isn't going to give lip service. You know, the beast will say, you know, may God bless America, that sort of, I mean, the Obama will. And the beast is going to present himself as the Most High. He is going to demean Yahweh. Yeah, it'd be like the Roman Catholic Church. They demean Yahweh. They'll demean Yahweh, and he's going to claim to be God. But wow. It's the only thing I would say that's different about this passage, these prophecies in Daniel, there's one aspect of them that is extraordinarily riveting, and that is that it's one of those prophecies that is so detailed and so accurate regarding the rise and fall of nations that all of those who want to deny that the Torah, prophets, and Psalms were inspired by God, they will all say that it was written after the events. Now, that's difficult because we have a 150 to 200 BCE copy of Daniel. But nonetheless, that's their only claim, is that it was written after these events took place, because the prophecies are just mind-bogglingly accurate in terms of what happened. But in today's world, you can read them now, and you know exactly, for example, where the beast is going to come from. He's going to come from Macedonia. I mean, there are no other options. He is coming from Macedonia. You can bank on it. And you can, you even know what nations he's going to ally himself with. In this case, it's going to be Italy, Greece, and Turkey. But so that's the first part of it. Is that it's just profoundly affirming that the prophets were inspired by Yahweh. But the one thing that's really different here is the lack of teaching. It is these prophecies are there just to tell you what's going to happen. It's not like when you analyze a prophecy in Yashayah or Yirmiyah, and 3/4 of the benefit, 90, maybe even 90% of the benefit, is the teaching that comes along with the prediction. In this case, it's pretty much, here's what's going to happen. And, you know, that, to some extent, that was even true in Yashayah 17 and 18. I think when we get to this period that is essentially satanic, the tribulation, I think when we get to that period, at that point, what's the point of teaching? God's going to say, this is what's going to happen. Once it happens, if you don't realize that you're on the wrong side and look at the places where he has taught, like his Torah, no, what good is going to be a systematic evaluation of the of Daniel, other than I told you so?
Yeah, it's kind of a point of no return. Point of no return.
Yeah, there are several affirmations in this, just as there were in Yeshaya 18, that once you hit the midpoint of the tribulation, 3.5 years into it, and God's very clear, 3.5 years in the tribulation, He gives you the number of days, He gives you the number of years. Once you hit the midpoint of the tribulation, you will either be on one side or the other. Now, at that point, Hasatan and his demons and his comrades will be doing everything they can to harass those who have embraced the covenant. And if you choose to embrace the covenant, it's going to be a very miserable experience for you. But you're good. Even if you don't endure it, your eternal fate is fine. But it is the one time for 3.5 years of human history where you do not have the option of death. No one's going to die and stay dead. Everyone is either going to go on to eternal life in Yah's home or eternal incarceration in Sheol. So it is I guess it's worth us communicating about this, because the moment you hit the midpoint of the tribulation, you're either friend or foe. There's no more middle ground. So it is it's humbling to read. It is it takes your breath away as to how bad it all is, what we're heading towards. I'd like to pick up where we were in the Mizmor, in the 119th. It was the 48th, which is the last verse of a stanza of 8. It reads as follows. So I literally lift up, raising the palms of my hands to God's authorized directions, which represent the terms and conditions of the covenant, which as a result of the relationship and beneficially I enjoy and desire, I actually adore. And I continually rejoice, wanting to find the joy in your clearly communicated and inscribed prescriptions that cut us into the relationship with you. Dode has summarized the Torah into 3 or 4 points, and he constantly emphasizes those points. So since this is the longest song to the Torah, and all the way through this process, Dode said there's 4 things you ought to be looking at here. There's 4 things I'm going to celebrate. There's 4 things that I love. And this is the person that that Yahweh called out by name. This is Dode, to say I love him. He is a righteous dude. This is the fellow that Yahweh is even going to model his kingdom here on earth after. Says here are the things you want to look at. You want to focus on mitzvah. Mitzvah, the terms and conditions of the covenant. You want to focus on choke, which are the inscribed prescriptions that cut us into the relationship. And you want to focus on, and he doesn't say it in this particular passage, but he says it so many other places, the Mishpat, which is the means that Yahweh used to resolve our disputes. And, you know, the Mishpat are, in essence, the 7 invitations to meet with God, the Moed Mikre, of which Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, we start the celebratory week with them on this Sunday at sunset. And the terms and conditions of the covenant, we know them. There's 5 of them. 5 things that God asks of us. All 5 of those things you can call requirements, and they are indeed requirements, but all 5 are benefits for us, as are the 5 promises associated with the covenant. And the entirety of the Torah is choke, prescriptions for living, in engraved and inscribed instructions that cut us into this relationship. That's the totality of the Torah. And Dode has an attitude here that is exactly the opposite of the Christian attitude. Paul wrote that the old system was pornography, that it was mean-spirited, that it was oppressive, that it was arcane, that it was depressing, that it was enslaving, that it couldn't save anyone. And if you violated one aspect of it, you were guilty of the whole thing. Mean, tough, terrible, awful, obsolete, horrible, mean-spirited. That was his view of it. Dode is saying, I love it. I just love it. I lift up my hands in praise. I love it. This is what I adore more than anything else in the world. So you have a basic conflict here with Paul on one side and Dode on the other. And since Yahweh called Shaul the plague of death and he called Dode righteous and vindicated, I suspect that we would be better off if we were in harmony with Dode's conclusion. Understand we have John on the line to
that.
Pardon? Yeah, that's, I mean, it's just really simple.
I said, that's what I want to be with.
Yeah, I first of all, I've spent a lot of time reading Paul's letters. I've spent even more time reading Dode's songs, the lyrics of Dode's songs, David's songs. And I can tell you without equivocation that the worst writing I have ever read, and I think it even compares negatively to Muhammad's Quran, are Shaul's letters. They are repulsive. They're horribly written. They're mean-spirited. They're a tangled mess of lies. It's horrible writing. And you read Dode's Psalms like this one, and you can't help but be inspired. He's the most brilliant mind in human history. The comparison is man versus God. You know, one guy was inspired by God, the other one was the adversary of God. Before we go on to the next stanza, I understand that, John, you have a question.
Yes. This is John from Texas, and I have sent you some emails before, John, and we even talked on Chattering Myths about a site that, you know, where the guy was saying that Jesus' only words were the only ones that mattered. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm going to ask you about is...
Well, by the way, of course, Yosha doesn't agree with that.
I'm sorry?
I said, Yosha would never say that only his words matter. Yosha said exactly the opposite. He said that every stroke of every letter of the Torah is what matters, and that he was the living manifestation of the Word of God. So according to Yosha, it's the Word of God that matters, which would be the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms.
Exactly. I totally agree. And thank you, by the way, for answering those things that on Chattering Men earlier. The feasts are coming up, and this is my first time. And I called maybe 3 weeks ago or so, and I think Larry was there then, but, you know, a lot of us just want to know how, and we know you can get, we don't want to be ritualistic about it or legalistic, but how do you celebrate the oncoming feast? Just in you can go into as much detail as you want, but could you do that? Could you talk about that soon?
Yeah, sure. I tried to spend about an hour and 45 minutes today in Shattering Myths, talking about the invitations to meet with God, beginning with the first three that we'll be celebrating, starting Sunday evening. And the presentation today in Shattering Myths was unique to anything I have done previously, which was the best way, perhaps of all, to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim is to celebrate the Torah. And that was really the point I was trying to make today, is that we are introduced to Yahweh in the Torah. We come to know Yahweh through the Torah. The entire purpose of these parties is to spend time with, get to know, and benefit from Yahweh. All seven of these feasts, all seven of these invitations to meet with God are presented only in one place, in the Torah. They're explained only in one place, in the Torah. The Torah guidance directs us as to how these invitations harmonize with, support the covenant. And so it strikes me that the best way to celebrate them is to celebrate the Torah. And we can do that because these are parties to meet with God. I mean, that's the purpose of these, is to answer Yah's invitation and meet with him on these days with a understanding of what he is offering. What is he offering? To make us immortal, to make us perfect, to adopt us as his children. And although it's still another seven Shabbat to Shavua, which is the celebration of the promise of seven, it's still linked to these first three, making it a group of four, because that's where we are enriched and empowered. And so, John, or if I can use your rightful name, Yahweh Kanan, I think that the single best way to observe Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkotim is to observe the Torah. Because, and the point I wanted to make today on Shattering Mess was that because Yahweh proves that he is God through his explanation of creation, through his explanation of the flood, through his detailed explanation of ancient history, and by way of his prophecies in the Torah, since he proves that he is God, proves that he inspired his Torah, what a wonderful place to spend time with him and to celebrate this enormously valuable gift that he has given us. And in that regard, you can read the Torah regarding the covenant, read the Torah regarding Yahweh's explanation of his name, read the Torah regarding his relationship with Noah and the symbolism of the ark, read the Torah regarding Abraham's dress rehearsal for Pesach, where Abraham traveled to Mount Moriah, and at the top of Mount Moriah prepared to sacrifice his own son. Yahweh said, "Here I am. I will provide the sacrifice," explaining exactly what he would do 40 Yobel later. What a wonderful way to celebrate Pesach, is to understand how the covenant was affirmed. The covenant was conveyed. The covenant was honored right there with the fulfillment of the promise of Pesach 2,000 years before. Yahusha honored that same promise with the death of his physical body as the Passover lamb. So I think that when you talk about how the Passover lamb, the blood of that Passover lamb was smeared on the doorways to life for the Israelites who were at that time under the control of an extraordinarily oppressive religious, political, military, and economic regime. And through that doorway of life, Yahweh freed them from that. What a wonderful way to celebrate Passover. Now, in terms of just the functional things to do, it's the 14th day of the first month of the year of Abib. Abib is extraordinarily important. Again, you can celebrate Passover just by talking about Abib. What does it mean? It means that the barley, which is the primary symbol for Yahweh's saved souls for his children, is barley, standing grain. The grain is standing, and yet the kernel is still growing and ripe, receptive. In the kernel when we celebrate Abib. And then on the 14th day, which means as the sun goes down on the 13th day of Abib, we celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim. Three successive days, and we celebrate what those days represent for 7 days, because everything with Yahweh is based on seven. Of man plus God equals his idea of perfection. And it's always on a full moon, the maximum amount of light, that we celebrate Pesach and Matzah and Bikurim, always with the maximum amount of light, perfect for camping out with God. The meal is prescribed very simply. It's the thing that makes eternal life possible is God's provision of him becoming the Passover lamb. And so we roast lamb. He doesn't want us to boil it. He wants us to roast it. Roasting it over a flame. You know, it's not hidden in a kettle. It's not tucked away. It's for those of us who have barbecues, roast it on a barbecue. You know, grill it on the barbecue. And he wants us to begin this process with matzah, with unyeasted bread, because Passover is part of unyeasted bread. There's no purpose in Passover without unyeasted bread. And so the first day of unyeasted bread, the first day of matzah, is really Passover. And that's why the unyeasted bread is prescribed. And it's not just unyeasted bread, which it is, but it's unyeasted bread dipped bitter herbs. And, of course, that means it was dipped in olive oil and bitter herbs, with the olive oil, you know, symbolic of Yahweh's set-apart spirit, of his anointing his children, of his setting apart his children, preparing us to serve, which is an extraordinarily important aspect of this relationship. And we drink red wine and as a symbol of the blood of the Passover lamb right there on the doorway. We eat unleavened bread as a symbol of as God's making us immortal, he's perfecting his children. Also, we can be adopted. And so I can tell you that I think the single most important thing you can do is observe Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim from the perspective of the Torah, which means to observe the Torah. It's not so much what you do. It's not only just what you know. It's not just what you understand. It's your attitude towards all of this stuff. What does it mean to you? How do you celebrate the day? And celebrate the day by getting to know Yahweh better, to accept what he has offered. And I'm going to add one other thing to this, and then, JB, I'll let you tell if you think that there's other things that we ought to be thinking about here, and I think we now have Larry with us as well, is that the more we equate these invitations to meet with God and to be called out of this world with the covenant, the better. I think that when we recognize that Yahusha in the fourth era of human existence, 4,000 years after Adam and Chawa had been booted out of the Garden of Great Joy, that he fulfilled the first four because the first four deliver all five of the benefits of the covenant. And that these first four facilitate the process that God delineated in terms of even the conditions for our participation in the covenant. So I think the more we equate the covenant, the fact that God is asking us to stop depending on man's way and rely on him and his way, which is this, the only way God's got is the mikra, the beginning with the doorway of Passover. And then second, to look at how when you study the covenant, you come to see these invitations as the means to facilitate it. So I would strongly encourage, and I know this is what I do, is I equate every aspect of these invitations to meet with God and to be called out of this world, to be welcomed by Him, which is what Mikra means, where, based on the verb kara, we read and recite His testimony with the covenant and with the Torah. And the more they're integrated together as one collective whole, I think the better off we are, the more we get out of them, the greater the benefit. What do you think, Larry and JB?
I think it is a collective one whole, and I'm gonna celebrate down near Daytona and on Sunday at sundown, and Monday I'm not gonna work, and you know I'll be reading the Torah for 3 days, so
yeah,
I'll probably open up Yada Yah and read right from there. So
yeah, and that is the celebration of them. To celebrate with Yah, if we look at this 119th Psalm, every bit of this, and particularly this last statement, he talked about it being a celebration, the thing that he loved to do. He was when you throw your arms in the air, you're celebrating. And so Dod was celebrating by observing the Torah. And so if it was appropriate for Dod, who God says, that's my favorite dude of all time, to celebrate by observing the Torah, then maybe that's the best advice for us too, that we should celebrate these by observing the Torah, recognizing that without the Torah, we don't even know about them. Without the Torah, we don't even know Yah. Without the Torah, there is no covenant. There are no Mikra. There is no Yah. We are 0-for-3 in those things, and all three of those things dominate the Torah. That is the essence of the Torah.
Well, you know, you had an old partner you wrote a book with, or of a book with, and I had it out with him and one of his followers who were very angry that I would copy and paste words from Craig. And I said, you know, I didn't realize accurate translations were Craig's words. I always thought they were Yahweh's words and they were supposed to be shared. I said, but, you know, they got to the point that defending Paul that Peter even, and I said, you mean Shimon? And he replaced circumcision with baptism.
Yeah,
really?
Sure he did.
I said, so that would make him a liar too, huh? You know,
yeah.
I said, you people have to pull everybody down in order to, you know, defend your man there, you know. And
that's
pretty
let's
unbelievable.
Say that that Shimon made a mistake. Let's say, and we know that Shimon made a mistake because one time when, right after Shimon had correctly said that, that you are the Maaseyah, the work of Yah, the Son of the Living God, right after he had made that declaration and Yosha had responded by saying, you know, this is the rock, the foundation upon which I'm going to build my mikre, my called out invitations. That right after that, Shimon was begging Yosha not to go to Jerusalem. And so Yosha turned to Shimon and said, get behind me, Satan.
Right, and that was a mistake. And
right.
Everybody
and so,
makes mistakes.
Right,
and I can see why he wanted to protect him. You know, I get that.
Right. So is it possible that Shimon made another mistake? Absolutely. But
yeah. Well, I didn't ever read where he said that circumcision had been. I thought that was the whole point of the Jerusalem summit. In fact,
of course it was.
Because they told me I missed that point, and I said, "Well, you must have missed the point of the Jerusalem summit."
Yeah. But let's just say that I'm not agreeing. I'm not suggesting that Shimon made this mistake.
No, I don't think he did.
I don't think he did.
Anyway.
But even if he did, hypothetically, if he did, how does that change anything about circumcision?
It doesn't.
Yahweh said, if you're not circumcised, you cannot participate in the covenant. He said, if you're not circumcised.
I think he said that was for all time. Eternally.
For all time. He said, if you're not circumcised, you cannot participate in Passover. He said, if you're not circumcised, you can't enter my home in heaven.
That's right.
So if let's just say hypothetically that Peter, decided that he would replace circumcision with baptism. How does that, in any way, shape, or form, change God's position? Does that make
sense? It doesn't, and that's a bad hypothetical because he never did it. And I'm absolutely amazed at the depths people go to defend, you know, those
right.
who are Torahless. You know,
well,
it's
take
amazing.
That hypothetical another step and make it not Shimon saying it, but say Yahweh said it. Then that makes Yahweh unreliable because he's unchanged his mind.
That was my point. I'm glad you emphasized it because I didn't say it in those words, but that was the point I was trying to make. Yes. If, in fact, that is the argument you're going to make, you're going to say, screw Yahweh. His testimony doesn't matter. I find confirmation of Paul's testimony with another man. So since it's kind of like Akiba's deal. I got two Jews that are agreeing on one thing, and Yahweh disagreeing with them. The Jews outvote Yahweh, so the hell with Yahweh.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. That's that argument. I mean, it's what.
Well, my argument.
Maybe what
to
you
them
just said.
Very
that is in fact the argument. Is God's testimony doesn't matter if you can get three people together or two people together that agree on a different approach.
Right. Well, my argument was, I'll tell you what: two religious clowns don't make a hill of beans to me. And, if you can't walk out of Babylon, and then he said, and I'll be celebrating Passover. And I said, you're not welcome at my table, clown.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and you darn well better be circumcised or it.
Oh, he made that a point. He is circumcised.
Okay, well.
As he runs around pushing nonsense. Well, you know, Sheol was circumcised.
Of course he was.
You know.
And so was his boyfriend.
Sure.
Now, you know,
yeah,
one
he
of the
was forced to do that, and I pointed that out to him.
Yeah.
You know, that was, he wasn't happily doing that. He was debating against circumcision.
Oh,
remember?
Yeah, his whole argument was, in fact, he went so far as to say, you know, Yahweh says, if you're not circumcised, you can't take place, part in Passover, which means you can't be, immortal. That's what Yahweh says. Paul says, if you are circumcised, then his Christ does you no good, which means if you're circumcised, you can't be saved.
No,
so their positions are exactly the opposite.
He went so far as to say, I wish them all castrated, right? I mean, let's get real. I put it right down there, and I said, you know, and the attacks on you are just getting old, to be honest. And frankly, the attacks on me, because I copy and paste.
Right.
So I copy and paste accurate translations into a debate, so you get to debate Yahweh's words, not mine.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about all of this, and I'm going to make just one comment. I'm going to make two, but the first comment is the Facebook site of representing the guy that I did co-author
the clown.
Facebook with, the clowns that is now associated with him. That wouldn't even be known if it wasn't for the fact that I host his books, and I provide links to his books. And there aren't 15 people on the planet that would have read his books if it wasn't
for the fact that I pay
to host his books, and I provided the links to his books. And if it wasn't for those things, there aren't five people on the planet that would have read them. Now,
that's right.
Beyond that. There is one thing that I do not mind. There's a lot of things that bother me. And I want, Larry, since you made this point, I want to be really clear on this. There are times when I am annoyed that I am personally harassed and attacked. I am never annoyed. I am never bothered. Nor do I ever want to be defended if the attack is my best efforts to properly convey what Yahweh had to say. If somebody wants to criticize me in that light, which is what they were criticizing you for, you do not need to defend me. I am delighted. I am thrilled to be criticized for doing my best to accurately convey what Yahweh had to say. You know, if you're going to be harangued
this
or something,
was
my friend,
the criticism.
That's the
of
badge
you
of honor.
Was, was your terrible translations, and quite frankly, you know, I mean, I which word is wrong?
Which word is wrong?
You know, nobody ever steps up and can show me what word is wrong. Do you know that?
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm going to jump a guy about his translations, yeah, as an example, if somebody said to me that the beginning of all knowledge is the fear of the Lord, I'd say, well, you got a pretty lousy translation there.
Yeah.
You know, and I could lay that out. I could expose it. I can show why. Okay?
Now, I'm going to tell you that when it comes to the translate, I'm working right now on translating Daniel. I'm in the towards the midway through the eighth chapter. And I'm going to tell you, like right now, I am in a passage that I have now worked on, one passage I have worked on for 5 hours. And I have looked at everybody else's translations of it. I have, and finally, as I studied the Tanakh as published by rabbis, actually, I began to see, okay, I can take the words at their most consistent meaning and can render this intelligently. But I want to say it is extraordinarily difficult. And so I don't ever want to claim that my translations are perfect. They're not. All I can claim is they're as accurate as the best tools and the most devoted effort is capable of making them.
Now here's another thing. I don't.
And by the way, they're a lot more
accurate
than standard English translations because they're a lot more.
There we go. That's right. And by the way, I don't think you ever said that you're inerrant. In fact,
no.
I think you've claimed the opposite. And unlike some former partners of yours and co-authors of yours, whatever you want to say, instead of saying Yahweh, you began to understand you'd made a mistake because it's Yahweh, Yahweh. You know, and you corrected that.
Correct.
And when you correct a mistake, and I understand why you corrected it, I thought hey was just hey. You understand? But
right.
then you know you broke it down as to why it's ah. And I get it. But you know, some people will never correct their mistakes. They'll stay with what they've got. Just because they don't want to admit they made a mistake. And I have no respect for that.
No. And even then, Larry, and this is important for everybody that's listening here, even when I said I was wrong with Yahweh and that it is Yahweh, I took the time to say, this is the reasoning. Here are the words that tell you how to pronounce each of these letters. And then I went through and gave, you know, like 20, 30, 40 examples. And then I look at it from every possible way and say, all right, it's 99.99% certain that the hays are pronounced ah, because 99%, and it's actually about 99.9% of Hebrew words with a hay are pronounced with an ah sound. So I said,
I don't see a word, by the way, pronounced the other way. I can't think.
Well,
of
no,
word.
There are some because I mean I was really thorough here. I said, you know, I'm going to do the homework, and I looked at every one of my lexicons, and I looked at every single word in every single lexicon. You know how thick the lexicons are of Hebrew? I looked at every single word and every single lexicon, and I counted how many were one way verse or another. I am certain that we're pronouncing the yod and the hey correctly, which means the only letter that is open to discussion is the wa.
I can still hear it.
Okay. And so with the wa.
I'm hearing that, and I understand that. And there's another aspect to that, by the way.
Yes.
Because it is that way. And because, you know, if you understand Yahweh's nature, I think the term you use is he wasn't coy about sharing his name 7,000 times.
Right.
You know, and then he has it embedded in all these other names that hold his name in a contracted form.
Right.
And, you know, what I know about Yahweh is unlike the rabbis and unlike
right.
religious leaders, he was not interested in hiding his name. He
no.
was completely about sharing his name. So why would he throw us off track? And he
yes.
didn't throw us off
why,
track.
Why would the letters in
his nature.
Name be pronounced differently than they are in every other Hebrew word? That
it
would
be
sinister.
Be.
It wouldn't be. But
it would be sinister.
Yeah. Now, I want to tell you that the single most important Hebrew word of, in terms of, if you're looking for guidance, if you're looking for instruction, if you want to be taught how to properly observe or recite or say something in Hebrew, the single most important term, without any question, is Torah. Because it is the source of Yahweh's teaching and guidance and instruction and direction. So if you want some direction on how to pronounce his name, you go to the Torah. And in Torah, there is no chance whatsoever that the Wah in Torah is pronounced you. It's not Torah. And so that for me was more than anything unequivocal. But beyond that, I looked at every Hebrew word that is commonly pronounced today, where we are as sure as we can be of any words, how they're properly pronounced, and Elohim is from Eloah, where the O sound is from the Wa. Shalom is the O sound is from the Wa, and it's just every
goy.
Word, yeah, goy, goyim, is pronounced O, but. Here's the thing that was the lay-down hand for me where I said, okay, I'm convinced. I'm still going to present all the evidence, and I'm going to tell people that, you know, they're free to examine the evidence, and I would encourage them to do so, and they may draw their own conclusions. But the one that was the final confirmation for me was the 100 or so names that are a contraction of Yao, like Yoel. Yao is God. Yob. There's 100 or so of them. And in all of them, there isn't a single lexicon that will tell you anything other than it's a combination of Yahweh's name and another Hebrew word. And since there are 100 of them, and they all maintain the O sound, it's just obvious. I mean,
right,
really
and there,
is
of course,
obvious.
there was a group out there for a long time, and I think they've almost finished embarrassing themselves from the Hebrew roots movement. Everything that was a W was a U, so it was Tura, and of course, you wouldn't have a Moed Mikra, you'd have a Mud Mikra, and I mean,
yeah.
It sounded like a caveman wrote it.
Yeah,
know?
And a lot of
some of them still do.
Yeah,
it's
a lot of the messianic types. Replace the W with a V, which is the rabbinical
agreement.
So it's, I think it's important that we recognize that when it comes to Yahweh's teaching, that we never go beyond the Torah, prophets, and Psalms unless it is to consider Yahusha's testimony regarding the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and that God gave us a means of defining all of his terms because they were originally written with pictures. And almost every word that might have some question as to what it might mean is defined by Yahweh in its first use in the Torah. So it's, well, I'm not going to claim that it's easy to translate. I am going to tell you that if you are open to the tools that Yahweh has provided and recognize that he always defines his terms and that he consistently uses his terms, it's not all that difficult. The only challenges I'm going to say now to translation of Hebrew, I'm not going to claim of Greek. I do not have an affinity for Greek because I recognize that the Greek text, even the oldest manuscripts in Greek, are a translation of what was said into a language ill-equipped to communicate those thoughts. So I'm not fond of Greek, and I know that the Greek text has been very poorly maintained. So you can't amplify the Greek text the way you can the Hebrew
right.
text.
It's not scripture.
It's just not.
No,
so
yeah, I know.
One of the things with Hebrew is that with only two exceptions that I'm aware of, if you're willing to invest the time, anybody can come up with a pretty decent translation, a reasonably accurate translation. All you have to do is use an interlinear and have more than four or five Hebrew-English dictionaries available. And you can do a pretty decent job.
I can do it.
Yeah. I mean, all of us can do it. We're not scholars. We can do it. It's not hard. Now, the one thing that I will tell you is hard is that when you're dealing with modern-day prophecy, when Daniel is trying to describe visions that he's seen with an ancient lexicon describing events that are occurring in our world, or Yahshiyah is trying to explain airplanes and tanks and nuclear explosions, I would say that takes some doing because there isn't a foundation of knowledge for those words. Those words appear once or twice in the whole of the prophets. And so that's
right. And also, yeah, exactly, it's not something you're going to see, you know, flying war machines with drivers
right.
in them. I mean, he's talking
right.
about this one particular time in this one battle. Of course, you know, had they written that down, you know, when they started doing their stuff, you know, a couple thousand years back, then, or 1,500 years ago, it would not have made a lot of sense. And, of course, now it does make sense. So, you know.
Correct. So, we'll move on here. We have a couple of other questions. But with these thoughts, Yahweh constantly asks us, encourages us to observe His Torah, to observe the covenant that is the heart of the Torah, to answer His invitations and to observe the Mikre, which Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim are upcoming here. To observe means to closely examine and carefully consider. The best way you can do that is to look at the words that He used to convey this message to us in His Torah. And you can examine them using interlinears and dictionaries, lexicons. And you can examine them by looking at the pictures that are presented by the letters themselves. And you can then compare those words to how they have been used elsewhere. And you can look at the roots of those words. And when you do that, you are following His advice. You are closely examining, carefully considering His testimony. And I'm going to tell you, if you do that, even if you come up with different translations, different renderings, different options than I have provided, you are going to be the beneficiary. It's just the single best thing that you can do with your time is to consider what He had to say. Now, do you have to do the translation yourself? No, you can do what Larry does. You can look at the translations. You can look at the words. You can amplify, see the amplification of them, and then contemplate them and consider them, and you get all the benefit. That's the advice. Do that. I think if you're a fellow like JB, and you're like the majority of people that I encountered along the way with Yada Yah initially, which is what you were reading made so much sense, but it was so different than anything else you had considered that you initially, and there's a lot of folks like you, that went and verified the meanings. They looked up the words, because all the words are presented in the translations. They looked up the words to see, is that an accurate rendering of those words? Can those words mean those things? And you did it a few hundred times. And after a few hundred times, and you found that, yeah, that's what those words mean, that after a while, you don't need to do it anymore. that you actually know.
Well, there's
still
a benefit in doing it. If rather than translate it yourself, all you did was, as you go through yada yada, look up every word. Not so much to check the translation, but just to get a better understanding for the word. If that's all you did, you would get so much more out of it than you would just reading it.
To underscore that, JB, I still do that. I mean, how many times have I come across L? How many times have I come across Kara or Beirut? How many times La, which is the preposition that means to approach, Dabar, word, Zakar, recall. How many times Asher speaks of relationship and of benefit? But you know, even though I can read the word, I know what the word means, I could translate the word without looking it up, do you know I still check multiple lexicons every time? And I'm always saying, you know, is there anything I should add to this? Is there another nuance of this word that helps us more fully amplify what's being conveyed? So even, you know, here I spend 10 hours a day, 6 days a week doing this. I still look up the words.
I like it when people who haven't spent 2 minutes doing it attack somebody that spends hours a day doing it that has a brain. And further, why don't you start adding command and do and obey, you know, because your former co-writer can't get away from those things, apparently.
Well, of course, because he loves the New Living Translation, which I think is, first of all, it's not a translation.
Ugh.
It's not even close to a translation.
Milk.
Yeah, it's an extraordinarily liberal paraphrase. And it's not even an accurate paraphrase. And so he loves that, and of course they love the obey concept because it fits in with Pauline doctrine.
Yeah, because it trashes the Torah.
Yeah.
It makes
the
Torah 613 laws. It
right.
puts them right on the side
of
the rabbis.
Oh, I know.
That's
you
amazing.
Can write a book called the Torah Code and analyze each of the 613 mitzvot as laws, not recognizing that there is no 613, that Maimonides was a lost soul, and that there isn't a law. Every aspect of the Torah is designed to be liberating. You know, I was there was a story, a news story, in Shattering Myths that I reported on this week, where a Christian pastor from Calvary Church was like so many other Christian pastors. He was having an affair with somebody else. He was married, and he was having an affair with somebody else's wife who was in his church. And the church drummed him out, said, "You can't be here anymore." So they were unwilling to forgive him. You know, you're out of here. And yet Dode, who's the author of this psalm, who is Jonah's favorite guy, committed adultery every single day. So you tell me, which system is freer? The Torah?
Yeah, you don't have
Dode
to
would
convince
hear to,
me.
Or their gospel of grace, which condemns you for doing anything outside of what Paul says you can do. You know, what's interesting is that Paul, which wrote half the Christian New Testament, condemns the law, as he calls the Torah, for being restrictive and demeaning and enslaving, and it doesn't have a word for obey, and yet one of Paul's favorite words is obedience, and it's obedience. The whole thing is just so hypocritical.
No, it's unreal. There's you go where the words lead you, you know. And you go where the words lead you, and they change your path from where you started.
Yeah. A great example of that would be a place where my former author and I have a huge difference. I recognized there was no such thing as a bodily resurrection. Yosha's body was not resurrected. And the reason I came to that conclusion is I went to where the words lead.
Okay.
The words lead to a realization that Yosha perfectly fulfilled every aspect. He was the living embodiment of the Torah. And the Torah says that the body of the unused portion of the Passover lamb is incinerated that night. Yosha's body had to be incinerated that night.
Then it made sense that nobody could recognize him.
Then the eyewitness accounts all of a sudden make sense. One of the things that looks like this huge problem, which is no one recognizes him. How can that be the basis of this new religion if nobody recognizes him? His mother didn't recognize him. He even said, "Don't touch me." He walked through walls. He was so radically different, no one recognized him, and now you know why. And now what you understand is the promise of Bukhodim is explained in the fact that he didn't have a body like you and I have. That he was
energy-based. Yeah, he wasn't limited.
Right. Now, as energy-based, could he, when it suited his interest, take on corporeal form and move along
he
in the
did.
Ordinary flow of time? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And when it was no longer beneficial to have a physical body, he was energy again. And when he, one of the things that's interesting is even after the upper room experience, where he walks in the room, they don't recognize him, and then he manifests himself in a way that they could see nail holes, and that's all they could tell from nail holes was that, okay, he's the same guy. Same individual, different body. But that after having seen him there, he then appears to the disciples as they're having a breakfast sale. And, they're all talking about, oh, my goodness, this is just, it was just boggling their mind. He goes and has one last meeting with them. And the purpose of the meeting, by the way, was to warn Shimon about Shaul. That was the purpose of the meeting. The entire text is warning Shimon about Shaul. But even at that meeting, after he's already met with them post-Bukhodim, they don't recognize him again, which means when he chose to manifest himself physically again, was never the same body. Didn't take on the same look. No reason to. He's trying to convey something to us in terms of what we're going to be like, about what the benefit, what the promise of Bukhodim is, what it means to be perfect and light. I mean, how could he be perfect if he's still covered in blood and wounds and gashes from the ordeal that he endured? How can
or
he
limited.
Be everlasting if he's dead? How does
or
man
limited.
Kill God?
Nobody perfect is limited.
Yeah, and you know, the single most important thing we can do in all of this is to be receptive to going to where the words lead.
Yeah, can I add one thing here since we're talking about this bodily resurrection?
Sure.
There are tons of bodily resurrections in pagan religions
prior to. Dionysus, for example.
So, see, these are all counterfeits.
Cyrus.
They're almost true, you know.
Yeah.
I just want to add that. This doesn't fit any of the pagan
concepts.
Right.
You know, the Christian Jesus is modeled after Dionysus. That's why Shaul quotes Dionysus' most famous line and puts it in the mouth of his wannabe god.
He must have read Euripides and all that.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's difficult to get against the goat.
Obviously, God kept up with all of that.
Especially when we speak in terms of, you know, him being in prison and the earthquake and the chains falling off and so forth. No, another ripoff, you know, it just goes on and on.
All right. I know we've gotten John's question. We've answered. I think we have Hendro and also Tony. Do either of you guys have a question that you'd like us to try to address?
Hello.
Hello, is this Hendro?
Yeah, this is Hendro.
Hello, Hendro. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Yada. Hi, Larry. I've got someone else here with me.
Yes.
It's Marcus.
Hello, Marcus.
Hi, Craig. Hello.
Hello, Marcus.
Yeah, hello to everyone.
Hi, Marcus. This is the first time I'm ever hearing you.
That's true.
Popular group.
Yeah, I've been many years that I've listened to this show.
Well, guys, this is going to be a wonderful Pesach, a wonderful Passover, matzah, and Bukurim, firstborn children for all of you. A first, I know, for Hendro.
Yeah, Marcus is actually on the cell phone. He's not here.
Okay.
I'm on my house phone. He's on the cell phone, but you can hear him okay.
Okay.
Hendro's idea, which I just thought was great, but carry on, Hendro.
No, you go ahead, Marcus.
It's a real pleasure to finally actually, you know, voice what I know and understand through the many years of kind of listening to this show and then comparing it with any sources that I can find, you know, and it's including, you know, the Yada Yada site, to comparing that with as many different sources as I can, and I think the comparison and trying to not base everything that I've learned just down to what Craig said has been part of the import of my experience into the knowledge that I've gained. But, you know, I think I do owe a bit of credit to the Yada Yada show, and you know, if it wasn't for Prophet of Steam and coming to know Islam, you know, that was the catalyst basically for how I'm actually talking to you today. So the real honour in a sense of knowing Yah, and the journey's only just begun. So it's been 7 years, mind you.
You know, Marcus, one of the things that I really struggled with for a long time was how could it be? Why was it that uniquely we were given insights in terms of, for example, the set-apart spirit is our spiritual mother. The covenant is the only thing that Yahweh cares about. The mikre all exist to support the benefits of the covenant. That there are five terms and conditions of the covenant. You just go through all of the profound revelations that we have come to understand from analyzing Yahweh's word. And I was always wondering, why aren't there other books, other sites, other sources, other shows, other programs conveying these same insights? It's so obvious. Why doesn't anybody seem to want to speak of Passover as the doorway to life? Why doesn't somebody want to speak of matzah as the means to scrub our souls of religion and politics? Yosha,
very strange. It's very strange because it's
why
does
anybody incorporate Bukurim with firstborn children when that's what the word means? And why are so few people aware that there is no renewed covenant? You know, and you go on and on, and for a while, I'm not going to say there was any doubt because Yahweh does such a thorough job of explaining what he is presenting and reinforcing it and proving that we can trust him. So I can't say there was any question, but there was still a wondering, since God made this so obvious, that even the timing of when the flood occurred, when the covenant was confirmed with Abraham, when Dod established the foundation for the temple, when Yosha arrived, and when he will return. Since it was all so obvious, there was the question of why aren't there more people embracing this? Particularly when you make the truth known to people, you'd think other people would be carrying this torch. And the only thing I came to realize is that Yahweh constantly tells us that very few people find the way to life. And he says very few people avail themselves of his mercy. He wrote in stone. He said thousands. And thousands amongst billions is one in a million.
Sorry to interrupt, but with some of the things that I think, I think have probably gone through my mind in the past that I've been either ignorant or, you know, just couldn't comprehend at the time was, how can you not be talking about millions? You know, it's this whole part of getting my mind out of the religious mindset of the Pentecostal church that I've been brought up to, believe in a Christian, sort of mindset where, you know, you kind of keep thinking that, oh, it's about people's good deeds, and you're obviously thinking in the back of your mind about family members too, and well, they've lived a good life with this and that. And I think so many things get overlooked and until people actually start to really question,
right.
Are
they willing to question? Yeah, so like when you find something in Habakkuk where Yahweh says, why are you unwilling to question him? And you're talking about
the guy whose name means question.
Yeah, it means question him.
Yeah.
And then, like, for example, when the Hebrew roots guy called in, when I told him that one of the glaring discrepancies between Paul and the Torah, he said, oh, there's no discrepancy between Paul and the Torah. And I said, well, one of the glaring discrepancies is Paul says that the Torah cannot save, and Yahweh says that the Torah is his means to salvation. And so he knew that Paul said that the Torah can't save, so he said, so where does Yahweh say that the Torah does save? And of course, I read him one of hundreds of statements that Yahweh makes, that the Torah is his means, his perfect means of restoring souls. And so they know that the conflict exists, they just can't deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish until my phone went flat today without... I've debated with, you know, I don't start off to start trouble with Christians. I mean, when I see them preaching out on Market Street or handing out the counterfeit leaflets with the Lord Jesus Christ on it. And, you know, I've learned a lot from debating for a start. Going from a family of very debating kind of people amongst my dad's brothers. And, you know, that's just kind of the mindset. And it's learning how to keep a calm about yourself so you don't sound like a lunatic yourself, losing patience or anything. And I've built a lot of patience speaking to lots and lots of people there in the city that I've got, that I'm from, just traveling home from work when I could just be thinking, oh man, I could just get in and just get a tea and, you know, get on with the rest of the evening. So, you know,
you don't bark
at time out. And I can tell you now, after loads of people speaking to about it, particularly Christians, you know, there's not always a right or wrong approach to go about it. It's just they're going to get a back up if you sound like you're going in with an attack. And even then, Hendro used a lot of pretty cool examples earlier that were speaking hours on the phone about, you know, how it's like for them taking in that information. And yeah, well, I think a lot of us have all been there. Some of them, it's just even...
Yeah,
anyway.
Let me share something with you here, Marcus, because this is near and dear particularly to Larry and I, who are confronted regularly by advocates of religion. Both of us will be patient, as patient as the full extent of the concept of patient. If somebody comes and say, I have a question, I have a concern, I don't understand, could you please explain, what does God have to say about this, that, and the other thing? If somebody comes and they are seeking, they want to learn, they genuinely want to know Yahweh, they want to know his name, they want to know what he's like, they want to know what he's offering, they want to know how to engage in a relationship with him. If somebody is seeking answers to those questions with an open mind, we will devote countless hours to them. Somebody, though, comes and want to do is promote their religion, and they want to promote whatever it is that they believe that is contrary to what God has to say, we're not very patient. There's a very, the Hebrew roots guy, I let him make 6 points, and then I shut him down. And then I spent the rest of the time explaining how each of his 6 points was wrong. I recognize the person that's advocating religion, I cannot help. Yosha himself could not help him. And so the only thing we can do in that case is to shut the person down, and when it becomes obvious that they're not here for answers, but instead to promote a religious myth, is after they have had a chance to make a reasonable number of points, then to expose and condemn the error of each of those opinions.
Absolutely.
And in that case, patience is not one of the is not an appropriate virtue at that point. You don't want to listen to them ramble on. Like Larry said, that when these people called and saying that Shimon Peter chose baptism over circumcision. Therefore, Paul was right in condemning circumcision. There's a very limited amount of time that you're going to spend listening to someone promote that kind of rubbish. It's not conducive to anyone's development or understanding. Shut them down, tell them where they're wrong, and move on with your life.
And to those people, Marcus and Hendro, I would say bullets.
Be a compassionate thing where it's thinking, well, these people probably need saving more than anyone, because I know the consequences, depending on how many people are probably misled, how many souls misled, promoting, you know, he had adversary fame and so forth. That's the people in the Pentecostal church that I used to, the pastors and all that.
Let me give you a great example on consequence, Marcus. When Yahweh was speaking about circumcision, and circumcision is important for us to be talking about here, because without circumcision, as a male, you cannot participate in Passover. And without circumcision, you can't be a member of the covenant. Circumcision is the sign of the covenant. It is no small thing. It is the sign of the covenant. Your signature, your commitment to the covenant is circumcision. Now, when Yahweh was speaking about circumcision, second only to the replacement of his name with the satanic title with Lord, God's anger at having his people promote the lack of circumcision is the thing that angers him the most. He gets absolutely irate in Ezekiel when he is talking about how unhappy he is with those who promote the lack of circumcision, because it's the sign, our signature, on the most valuable gifts in the universe, and he does not appreciate it. And he just said, you know, I'm going to tell you how black and white this is. If you're a male and you're not circumcised, both of the spirit and of the flesh, and the spiritual circumcision, I want to tell you, is important. That means that you have made the decision. You've come to know Yahweh. You've fallen in love with him. You understand what he's offering in his covenant. And you have said, I accept. I'm going to trust and rely on the terms and conditions of your covenant. I'm looking forward to the benefits. I accept. That's spiritual circumcision. But he says, unless you are circumcised spiritually and physically in the flesh, you cannot enter heaven. You will not ever enter his home. Serious situation. So when somebody's advocating something different than that, a different point of view than Yahweh's, there are consequences. It's a terrible thing to do.
Talking about circumcision, it's one of the things that I didn't entirely like. Paul wasn't all that bothered or interested in it. It only sprung so much to my mind when dawned on me after a few years of coming to discover Yahweh, the name Yahweh, and learn a lot from Yahweh Radio. And obviously, we went through to the point where we started questioning Paul, and that was like, all right, wow, this is. I have no doubts about this kind of passport. Man, I should have took this stuff further, because how obvious can it be? But then the other obvious part was, oh man, I'm going to have to get circumcised. I mean, how I kind of put that one to the back of my mind. And I went through a bit of a panic phase of thinking, how am I going to kind of do this, raise the cash for it? And I even went through the questioning God on, I thought we didn't have to work for our salvation. And the answers are just so clear and obvious now. But coming through that kind of tunnel,
that is my reaction to Paul, is that once you recognize that Yahweh called him out by name to call him the plague of death, once Yahweh described every one of his characteristics, Yahweh said when he was going to write, to whom he was going to write, what argument he was going to make, particularly against circumcision, and what his name was going to be. God laid it all out on Paul, and called him the plague of death. And at that point, How do you take a any position other than to be opposed to him? And at that point, aren't we, if we love Yahweh and we trust Yahweh, which we all do, how is it possible at that point not to use our minds, to use our eyes, to examine Paul's testimony, to examine Yahweh's testimony and Yahusha's testimony, and find the places where they are in conflict so that you can expose the fraud to people, to awaken them to the greatest deceiver who ever lived?
Yeah, successfully, yes.
And, by the way, once you understand Yahweh's perspective, once you accept Yahweh's perspective on Paul, which is to accept the Torah, once you do that, it's so obvious. Every bit of it is obvious. It's a it is a case that becomes wholly undeniable.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say that the what you have to walk away from, just absolutely true. If you aren't willing to walk away from Pauline doctrine, you can't have a relationship with God. It's just not going to happen. The Paul's
one
God
or the
is
other.
Pardon?
I
said it's one or the other.
And I like listening to Ken Powers I've read Questioning Paul quite a number of times now, and it just couldn't get tired of reading it, because the more you come to know something, the more the more comfortable you become in how you can even share that information with other people. But yeah, it's been one bit of a journey, this, and it's got me onto the path of where I am now. So it's no regrets. It's just you that I think the more fundamental people have been about the faith or religion, or the harder it is to scrub yourself off from these kind of things. But it's so obvious now, where it just seems pretty easy, thinking about it, well, why can't you just see the obvious? But when you're in that kind of mindset, it's not.
I know. It's hard. That's why religion is so difficult, because religious people, no matter how observant they think they are, how knowledgeable they are, they're just blinded. It's amazing how faith is corruptive. It's why God hates religion. It is an extremely poisonous tool that man has conceived that blinds people to the point that most religious people, even confronted with Yahweh's own testimony, rather than accept what God had to say, they find God's words repulsive. If God says, this is Passover, and to participate in Passover, you have to be circumcised, they would prefer to take Paul's words and say, no, you don't. I mean, even, it's amazing to me, but that's the nature of religion. It's the same thing, the nature of politics. It blinds people to evidence and reason. And so long as a person is religious, you cannot reason with them, which is why the prerequisite of the covenant is walking away from one's country, from Babylon, from confusion, which Yahweh explains is the influence of religion and politics. And until you do that, until you're willing to question it and walk away from it, then Yahweh, who is pure reason, Yahweh who has to be approached intellectually, you come to know him intellectually, what he has to say will not resonate. You will never understand who he is or what he's offering until you first open your mind by walking away from religion. It is a requirement, and it's a requirement that has to be.
Everything that I've heard being discussed on this radio show today, I've missed a couple of episodes of recent, so it's been a pretty good time to catch back up. But ironically and coincidentally, on a day that I was having just so many of these kind of points brought up that I could think of that would spring to mind, to try and share it, and waking up like these three guys that trying to kind of tear me apart and say that I was going to go to hell for all this. And, they were kind of really nasty at points.
Yes.
And those points are just not worth really sticking around. It's just,
no. we're sticking around. You know, Yahweh has told his covenant children that he's not going to judge them. That his promise is that we get to live eternally with him. So if somebody wants to condemn a member of his covenant family, they're not worth listening to. I'm going to instead celebrate what Yahweh has promised. That's why I love the 119th Psalm so much. Dode is celebrating Yahweh's promises. And he says, you know, it doesn't matter how flawed I am. It doesn't matter that I have enemies. It doesn't matter that people say nasty things about me. It doesn't matter. What matters is what Yahweh has said. It matters who he is, what he has offered, what he's put in writing, and what he's promised. And when that is your focus, you're always going to be right. You know, if you're willing to convey what Yahweh said, that's why the psalm is so good. It talks about how Dode wanted Yah's testimony to always be in his mouth. He wanted always to be a witness to Yah's words, because when we are, we can never be wrong.
Yeah.
Yana?
Yes.
Can I ask a question, please?
Sure.
I was talking to someone on the phone. I actually spoke to someone who's a reverend, and I asked him a question. I said, you say you're a reverend. I need to check to see who you are. And I said to him, God, and I want to know if this was correct, but I was using speaking Christianese and using the King James Version so he could understand. I said, it says that God went after Moses to kill him, and I said, can you tell me why God was doing that and who saved him and how? And I believe the answer was Miriam, and it was to do with circumcision. Is that correct?
Yes.
It's extraordinarily mistranslated. There is.
Oh wow!
Not,
okay.
Yeah, Yahweh was not interested in killing Moshe. There
okay.
was an argument in the Torah where Aaron and Miriam both attacked Moshe because Moshe chose to marry an African woman. And they thought that it was appropriate for Moshe to marry an African woman, and so they wanted to usurp his authority because he was speaking for Yahweh. And Yahweh supported Moshe and denounced Aaron and Miriam for that. So that was one example where Yahweh took Moshe's side. Now, Moshe did die a physical death. He is now in heaven. God had no interest in killing him. He is in heaven. God did scold him once, for example, when Yahweh said, I want you to speak to the rock to have water come out, and he instead hit the rock. And you might say, oh, come on, I mean, what's the big deal? But what the big deal is, there's a lesson there. Everything is a lesson. And the lesson is, Yahweh is really serious about his words. If he gives you instruction that he wants you to meet with you on Pesach, and it's the 13th day of Abib, then meet with him on Pesach on the 13th day of Abib. Don't call it Easter. You know, it's God's testimony. God's really precise. He's an extraordinarily effective communicator. Everything he said is for a purpose. God doesn't make living waters happen because he hits us, because of a striking. God brings life through words. That's why he said, I want you to speak to the rock. I don't want you to hit the rock. I want you to speak to the rock. Because life comes from his words. And we need to value his words if we're going to have a meaningful relationship with him. You know, this takes us right back to the first thing we were talking about at the beginning of this program, which is there is nothing more valuable than doing the best you can to try to fully appreciate what Yahweh is telling us. And that's the message there. So did God get angry at Moshe after all the time they spent together for Moshe bungling that? Yes, he did. But,
actually, I think he's referring to a different
situation. There's one, I cannot remember, and I'm looking, trying to find my notes on my computer right now, but it says that Yahweh came, met with Moshe seeking to kill him, and it,
yeah,
the incident is because Moshe had not circumcised his son, and it's Moshe's wife, and I can't recall her name at the moment, who circumcises their son then and there to save Moshe's life.
Yeah, but it's again, it's just I've been through that passage as well, and it's a horrible translation. God's if God wanted to kill Moshe, Moshe would have been dead.
Yeah,
he doesn't want to kill Moshe, but he does want he does want us to understand, and this is the there is a message there.
Yeah,
the message is that if you're not circumcised, you're going to die. And the instruction on circumcision wasn't that we circumcise ourselves. The message on circumcision was that we circumcise our children, our sons. And if we don't circumcise our sons are going to die. And what kind of a father would you be if you're not willing to follow Yah's instruction on a life and death matter like this? Circumcision is life and death. No circumcision. You can't participate in the covenant. You can't participate in Passover. You can't enter heaven. It's life and death. And so God is saying, you know, if you're not going to follow the essence of my communication, which is circumcision is the sign of the covenant, if you're not going to pay attention to the terms and conditions of the covenant, you aren't going to live. I mean, it is a life and death issue. And for God, God's not going to treat Moshe any different than he's going to treat you, Marcus, Hendro, even Larry, and no, not me. He is not going to cut a different deal for any of us. There's only one deal. It's the covenant. And circumcising our sons is life and death.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't do it, if we don't act upon the terms and conditions of the covenant, there is no salvation for us. We're going to die, no matter who we are. So the message to that, God's really serious about his testimony, which is so amazing to me that so few people are. They're willing to contradict him. They're willing to ignore him. They're willing to alter what he had to say. And, you know, and God's really clear. He is really, really a precise communicator, and he expects that we will at least listen to what he has to say, and if it's a life and death issue, that we'll act upon it. Davey, as you studied circumcision, is that recap of it consistent with what you came to, or is there something that I missed here? I don't want to mislead.
That was the inescapable conclusion. It was one of those things, like I said before, I had issues with it at first because it just didn't seem right, but you cannot deny that when you actually look at everything God has to say on the subject.
Yeah. I mean, we started this conversation on Larry bringing up that I had two people who were trying to belittle me for my focus on circumcision. By the way, I don't really focus on circumcision, but I certainly try to present circumcision with the same passion, the same perspective, the same importance that Yahweh does. And because it is one of the five conditions of the covenant, because it is one of the conditions for participating in Passover, and therefore going through that first step on the way to the to camp out with Yahweh. If you don't go through the doorway of Passover, you can't participate in any one of the other six steps. And because God says it's unequivocal, you cannot enter heaven unless you're circumcised as a male. I try to present circumcision from that perspective. I try to explain what it represents. You know, it's the part of the male anatomy that is responsible for procreation. It's the part that unifies with a woman so that a husband and wife become one, and that we become one in a mother and father. It's the place that we men have a tendency to focus on. And if we see our children, our sons circumcised, then we are making as parents a commitment to raise them in the covenant. And it's the perfect symbol for this. And it's beyond the fact that I think it's the perfect symbol for it. It's God's decision. He said, here's my rule. You want to participate in the covenant, you'll circumcise your sons. If you want to participate in the pathway to me, you'll be circumcised. If you want to enter heaven, you'll be circumcised. Well, I do care as to why he chose it. Who among us is going to say God can't establish the rules for his own home? I have not met the man who thinks that he can override God's decision on something that he is that emphatic about.
Yeah.
And so would I just naturally, because I love Yahweh and I want to spend my eternity with him, accept circumcision because he's established it in for these things, the doorway to life, entrance into his home, participation in his family? Yes. When he says it's the sign of the covenant and I want to participate in the covenant, would I just naturally accept it? Yes. I would trust him that there's a good reason for it. But when you just think about the reasons for it, it's obvious. The reasons are obvious.
That's one of those things which, yeah, it's one of the things. Yeah, I would listen to him, but I'm of the mindset I want to know why he said it. I'll do it.
Of course.
I mean, a lot of times I'll do something at first just not understanding why, but I constantly seek to understand why. And when you do it,
right.
You're like, oh, well, this makes sense now.
Right. Everything that Yahweh says makes sense, and the more you study it, the more you have an appreciation for it. Circumcision is one of those many things. And Yahweh, not only doesn't Yahweh mind when we question him, he likes when we question him. He loves it.
Where does it leave me in regards? I've got two sons, one's 26 and one's 17. Where does
yes.
it leave me? Because I didn't know.
Yeah, which I know. And the instruction was to circumcise your sons on the eighth day. You didn't know on the eighth day. You just didn't know.
Yeah.
Now, I can tell you what I would do.
Yeah.
I would contact both of them. I would say, this is what I have learned. And I want to right this wrong, and I'm offering to do this. Now, you're an adult, and you can say no, but I'm offering to get this done for you. And even if it took all of my savings to do it, I would offer to do it for my sons, and I would let my sons know in a personal letter why
yeah.
this is important. And so I would offer to do it.
Yeah.
But, Kendra, this is the thing that I think is important. All of Yahweh's instructions on things that have a bite. For example, he says, I don't want you to commit adultery. I don't want you to bear false witness. I want you to set the Shabbat apart and do what we're doing with the Shabbat. I want you to answer the invitations to meet with me. I want you to walk away from religion. All of those kind of instructions that have a consequence, they're all written in the imperfect conjugation. It's extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that if you are making an ongoing practice of killing people, of bearing false witness, of doing things you ought not be doing, if you are still engaged on an ongoing basis in Christianity, then you bear the consequence. But the moment you stop, you're no longer subject to the consequence. It says, don't make a habit of killing. If you killed somebody, but you're not in the military and killing people regularly, you're no longer subject to that. If God says, don't bear false witness, I was a Christian evangelist. I bore false witness. I don't anymore. I'm no longer subject to that because I stopped. And so every one of God's instructions like that is written in the imperfect. Now, that does not mean that with circumcision that you're going to be allowed as a male into God's home if you're uncircumcised. So, even if your parents did, you need to. But that's the answer to that question is that I think what you want to do now is offer and write a personal note as to why and what you've learned. And that, and then the second to that, realize that everything that's in the Torah in terms of what puts us in conflict with God is written in the imperfect, which means ongoing behavior.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Can I just add one more point? I mean, this has been since challenging the whole park has been circumcised and really kind of thinking, yeah, this is something I want to do for the last few years. You know, I've finally been able to get stable enough job. You know, I was doing a lot of agency work for schools, so I was looking always stable. But you know, I've ended up in a situation where after things go fantastically well working at the high schools, I just didn't like what academies were all about and all that kind of stuff. But particularly teaching education in that age group. But I just by chance ended up working at a primary school that the agency had sent me off to, that my one of my old friends that I knew from college, his dad's the headmaster, and from there, you know, it's what I could offer at school that counts, not that it's mates fun or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's what I'm guessing it's about. But he said, look, you know, I'd like to offer you the place after I asked, and you know, down the line, I ended up getting the contract signed. And, you know, it was a little bit before the contract's been signed that I was really close to kind of losing my job there for the sake of speaking out against Islam on a Facebook debate, mind you. And, you know, I've always been cautious of these things because I know where it can lead us. But it so happened to be a cousin that I'd put up for 6 months. And he ended up getting corrupted by Islam. You know, I think he just used it as the front, the ends justified the means within anything that he could, you know, just create conflicts with whilst living under the roof. So I had to ask him to leave for other reasons, not just because of that. He wanted to get one back. He emailed the boss, the mate's dad, that I'm a big Islamophobe and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
And the mate's dad was like, look, I know you, but just brush us under the rug.
Islam is such a diabolical religion. It's while Christianity appeals to people who are just lazy, it's a religion where if you're not willing to be resolutely rational, if you're not willing to take the time to be informed, it's easy to be fooled by Christianity. But Islam is just ruthless. It's grotesquely immoral. It is so utterly false and stupid.
I
mean, it's just stupid with a capital S.
That you just about it. That sprang into lots and lots of heated debates. And you know, he goes and takes it all personal by trying to get me fired from a job before I'd even been able to sign the contract. So then emailing the school governors. It's a really fine close line. And, you know, I don't see the need of having to pray when I know I can trust and rely on God anyway. And God knows what you know, when we make a sincere request, you know, if he's going to answer to that, then it was one of those which I said to myself, you know, God, you know, if I keep this job, it's not a case, can you micromanage the minds of these lives of the people employing me and make them give me the job still. You know, I felt I've not done anything wrong. I came out of it on top, and I managed to keep my job. And I said to myself all along, if I get to keep this job, I'm certainly going to have wanted to get circumcised and certainly going to be able to save up at least now. And, you know, it's better than not having a job. I wouldn't be in a position then to really know how to do that. So it's kind of working for my salvation or anything like that. Long in the past where he used to question that part of circumcised, what if you have to pay for this thing and then is that not conflicting with one's salvation? No, it doesn't even come close. You can't, not even anything on this planet could you could offer to pay the price that God's given us for this gift.
That's a sad situation.
I've got to come out on top of, and
But you know, if you put Christianity and Islam together, you've got half the world fooled by those two religions. So,
wow.
They are, and if you put socialist secular humanism in there, you've got three quarters of the world. So it's the story that you're telling is the normal story of man. That's why God said that thousands amongst millions will receive the benefits of His mercy, and that fathers corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation. That's why He said that the way is broad that leads to death and destruction. The vast preponderance of people prefer the lies to the truth. And so that's just our reality. We're going to continue to have to live within that reality and for the next dozen or so years, and then we get to camp out with Yahweh forever and be completely rid of religion. So the time has come that soon that you won't have to wrestle with that anymore, Marcus. Well, Marcus, and Andrew, I do have to run, but I really appreciate you guys calling in and for your input and for your testimony.
No problem.
Have a wonderful Pesach, Matzah, and Bekorim.
He's not got time.
Good night, Paul. Yes?
Angie has a question about a lamb chop.
Yada, hi.
Hi, Angie.
Hello, I'm sorry, you're rushing off. It's Angela here, Hendra's partner. It's just that this is also new to me, and I'm vegetarian.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really worried, what on earth am I supposed to do?
Yeah, well, the instruction is pretty clear. He does want us to eat lamb for Passover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so... If I were you, it doesn't say how much lamb you need to have, but God clearly did not create us to be vegetarians. I'm not going to besmirch your choice. That was your choice. But that's a human choice. The instruction on Passover is to have lamb and
mm-hmm.
Un-yeasted bread with bitter herbs and olive oil. And so,
I've got into it with one of the ladies in the group.
Yeah, he doesn't say how much. So, you could have the littlest, tiniest bite, even imaginable, so that you could pick it up with a toothpick, and it will suffice.
It's just going through the process of doing it. It's wanting to do it, the willingness.
Yeah, it's just, it's what it is. Are you, in your particular case, you've made a
mm-hmm.
choice to be a vegetarian. That's your choice.
And
what all God is saying is, if you're going to trust and rely on Him, the provision for eternal life is Passover, and the meal for Passover is roasted or grilled lamb, un-yeasted bread dipped in oil with bitter herbs and red wine. And so all he is asking is that you trust him. So if I were you, I would take the littlest, tiniest bite that you can cut it so that it is just almost minuscule.
I did eat meat for 40 odd years. It's when my daughter, who's now 25, about 12 years ago, she came home from school, my vegetarian. I was a single mom and I supported her with that, and I've been veggie since.
A human decision, and it's not a decision God never once says, I have a problem with vegetarians. If you want to be a vegetarian, that's your call, and God doesn't have an issue with it. But
mm-hmm.
on this one night each year,
okay.
trust him and have a little bitty tiny bite of lamb. Doesn't take much.
Today, I went against all my principles looking at some today for Henry. I thought, oh gosh, have I got to do this? I used to love lamb when I ate.
Do it for yourself and for him, because that's God's provision, and it's a marvelous story of what he himself was willing to do as the Passover lamb.
I understand. I know.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right.
For your time.
You're welcome. All right.
Night-night.
Good night. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.